And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
When this show aired just over a year ago, the price of a gallon of gas was at $1.85 a gallon. Energy independence was considered in March 2005 to be the dream of a few environmental extremists. Even progressive Democrats were talking about 15 to 20% of our energy needs coming from clean sources by 2025. Well, what a difference a year makes. With gas prices well above $3 a gallon, and the world quest for oil bringing about international instability, energy independence is suddenly on everybody's lips, from GM to GW. So this is a perfect time to give you the whole story, again, from John Kennedy to entrepreneurs, steel workers to urban centers. We were right then. That makes us double right now. Here is the full story of energy independence. You can choose to listen to the whole story, or listen to the segment that interests you. But in the public interest, we bring you once again, the Apollo Alliance.
We have ignition sequence start. Engines on, 5, 4, 3...
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Welcome to another special edition of the Wild Side News. On our first show of 2005, I announced the launching of the Decade of Discovery. This is a special Decade of Discovery program, which today brings focus to the emerging awareness that we, as Americans, must intelligently address the state and nature of our nation. Americans this week awoke to a sudden increase in gasoline prices of over 25 cents per gallon. There was no warning, except here on the Wild Side News. Our leaders, without exception, accepted such massive hits. That's a sudden 10% cost increase that will be felt in our economy across the board, without any indication that such even matters. Our journalists announced the increase as a 20-second soundbite. There is a disconnect of massive proportions between reality and this mediocrity that keeps us spinning and spinning and spinning. It's a dizzying, out-of-control system. Are we really supposed to just go on spinning as people, communities, nations, and the world? Are we just secondary or tertiary passengers on this downbound train? You know, what occurs to some, even many of us, is that there was a time when clarity of word and thought created secure futures for us all. Why can't we take back a sense of control, a sense that, with intelligence, goodwill, hard work, and what we all used to know as American ingenuity, we can work to restore our nation? The answers to these questions are many, but there are answers. And today, we just plain give you an answer. The Apollo Alliance brings massive numbers of people together in a vision and a strategy to create energy independence within 10 years. Now, that is something all of us who care about our families, our towns, our nation, and the world want. Should Americans want energy independence in 10 years? Is there any conceivable reason not to want that? Then why don't we set that as our goal, invest our will, our money, and our genius to get the job done? And in the process, recreate America into a leading player in the new battle to win the energy wars that will provide real stewardship to our Earth. The Apollo Alliance derives its name, mission, and spirit from a time when reason, dialogue, hope, and leadership were alive and well in America. I want to bring that voice of the Earth back so that we can remember how it was done. The date is May 1961, and announcing the launch of the Apollo Project to put a man on the moon in 10 years is President John F. Kennedy. Let's take a listen.
Finally, if we are to win the battle, that is now going on around the world between freedom and tyranny. The dramatic achievements in space which occurred in recent weeks should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take. Now it is time to take longer strides, time for a great new American enterprise, time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth. I believe we possess all the resources and talents necessary, but the facts of the matter are that we have never made the national decisions or marshaled the national resources required for such leadership. We have never specified long-range goals on an urgent time schedule or managed our resources and our time so as to ensure their fulfillment. I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. Let it be clear, and this is a judgment which the members of the Congress must finally make. Let it be clear that I am asking the Congress and the country to accept a firm commitment to a new course of action, a course which will last for many years and carry very heavy costs, $531 million in fiscal 62, and an estimated $7 to $9 billion additional over the next 5 years. If we are to go only halfway or reduce our sights in the face of difficulty, in my judgment, it would be better not to go at all. Now, this is a choice which this country must make, and I'm confident that under the leadership of the space committees, of the Congress, and the appropriating committees, that you will consider the matter carefully. It is a most important decision that we make as a nation. But all of you have lived through the last 4 years and have seen the significance of space and the adventures in space. And no one can predict with certainty what the ultimate meaning will be of mastery of space. I believe we should go to the moon. But I think every citizen of this country, as well as the members of the Congress, should consider the matter carefully in making their judgment, to which we've given attention over many weeks and months. Because it is a heavy burden. And there is no sense in agreeing or desiring that the United States take an affirmative position in outer space unless we are prepared to do the work and bear the burdens to make it successful. If we are not, we should decide today and this year. This decision demands a major national commitment of scientific and technical manpower, materiel and facilities, and the possibility of their diversion from other important activities where they're already thinly spread. It means a degree of dedication, organization, and discipline, which have not always characterized our research and development efforts. It means we cannot afford undue work stoppages, inflated costs of material or talent, wasteful interagency rivalries, or a high turnover of key personnel. New objectives and new money cannot solve these problems. They could, in fact, aggravate them further unless every scientist, every engineer, every serviceman, every technician, contractor, and civil servant gives his personal pledge that this nation will move forward with the full speed of freedom in the exciting adventure of space.
So today, we help launch the Apollo Alliance so that in 10 years, we can broadcast another historic landing. It will be then a relanding of people with their land, with safety and security for all, and the creation of a real global vision for peace and justice. So now, we open this special Decade of Discovery edition of the Wildside News as we talk with the director of the Apollo Alliance, Bracken Hendricks. I'd like to welcome Bracken Hendricks, who is the director of the Apollo Alliance, to the Wildside News. Bracken, where are you calling me from?
I'm calling you from Washington, D.C. at the moment. It's where the Apollo Alliance is based. But we've got folks all around the country. I'm actually about to head to Minnesota later today, where there's a really active coalition of steelworkers and Sierra Club members who are fighting for smart policies that create good jobs and create real energy independence.
Well, let's talk about what the Apollo Alliance is. Give us a heads up on that.
Yeah, if you can imagine four legs to the stool or four wheels on the cart that's moving us forward. It's really a coalition of business, environmental advocates, labor or workers' rights advocates, and community members, and that can mean civil rights and social justice folks who are pushing for urban redevelopment, and also rural economic development advocates. So we've got community, business, labor, and environment. And we feel that together all of these folks have interests in a smart, forward-looking economy and really achieving something real on energy independence and breaking with the lack of vision of the past.
Let's say that the Apollo Alliance, as this coalition of people and organizations, come together. What is the objective?
We're trying to achieve real energy independence over the next 10 years. We think that there's a whole host of things that we can do and build that will make our economy safe. It'll make our country safer and more secure. It'll also make our economy stronger and create real prosperity, and it'll rebuild our communities. We're talking about everything from making sure that the next generation of super efficient, high performance cars are built by American workers and American plants, that we keep our auto industry. We're also talking about rewiring the electrical grid. A huge number of jobs are needed. We have an antiquated system. Not only would we achieve reliability and security, but we could also bring on a whole new generation of technology in solar and wind. That means construction jobs. It means manufacturing jobs. It means less pollution. It means that we can re-enter the global community without being afraid that controls on emissions are going to hamper our economy. And it means greater public health. So, you know, the benefits are huge, and they're economic, they're social, they're political, too. Right now, our national security is totally intertwined with unstable and undemocratic countries in the Middle East, and it really distorts our foreign policy, the fact that we're over-reliant on oil. And we use the oil inefficiently. It's not necessary. We could have a better quality of life even as we use less of it or use diverse fuel sources. We could create jobs for farmers. We could create jobs for machinists and steel workers. And we could create jobs for construction workers rebuilding our cities.
The Apollo Alliance takes its name from the Apollo project that put man on the moon in 10 years. It would seem like a dream when it was proposed. And to some extent, this is a dream as well, but is it possible to do so?
Oh, it's completely possible. One of the things that's interesting about this, in a way, the challenges are more dire and more dramatic now than they were back then. The threats to our national security and to our global environment are tremendous now. Far more dangerous than the missile gap that was faced by John Kennedy. But yet the technologies are simple. They're all in hand. I mean, these are things that we can do now. It's not beyond our technical capacity. There are some barriers to overcome about commercializing new technology, but nothing that America can't do if it dedicates its will, if it puts real investment behind the challenge, if we marshal our scientific, technological, and research resources to this task. The thing that's missing, really, is leadership. I mean, John Kennedy stepped forward to the American people with just an audacious claim that we could put a man on the moon and safely return him home again within the decade. You know, most of that technology didn't exist. But he made a federal commitment. He used the resources of the federal government, our defense investments, and we did it in 8 years. You know, we beat the Russians, and we actually created a revolution in our industrial productivity, and we created a lot of technologies that built the middle class. And this is actually something that we think is critically important and is frequently overlooked in today's political debate, is that there are some challenges that individuals and markets can't overcome by themselves. And that's why we have a government. That's why we have public institutions that make us stronger by standing together. Public investment in appropriate infrastructure that creates economic opportunity is nothing new to America. We built the canals. We built the railroads. We did rural electrification when no company could have the appropriate profit motive to string wires out into the Tennessee Valley. We made sure that as a matter of social justice and national security and economic growth, that the entire country was electrified. More recently, we used our defense investments to do the basic research that led to the internet and the telecommunications revolution. Those investments were too risky for the private sector to move into. But once the basic science was done, it was clear that it created entirely new industries and a massive wave of job creation and growth across the country. An interesting thing about the internet revolution also is that we think of it as a white-collar job creator. But in fact, many, many, many of the jobs that were created are blue-collar and in fact disproportionately benefited low-income and minority communities, creating career ladders into the middle class. Things like actually stringing up new fiber optic cables or managing networks and systems within offices. These became new career ladders into technology and into white-collar jobs for folks who'd previously been shut out of economic opportunity. So this is exciting because it's broad-based. It really touches the whole economy.
I think the point that this type of approach really is a broad spectrum to revitalizing the American dream, the American vision, the American economy, the American environment is critical. And as it reaches down into workers, and you make the point, with the digital revolution came a speed up of a need to communicate, to deliver, to produce. And that did affect people for UPS and FedEx and postal workers and things that suddenly there was this new need to have things delivered faster. And so it's unusual. We never know quite how these technologies will transform our societies and affect the entire spectrum of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. You can tell when you're facing one of these sorts of situations. I mean, we have right now challenges to our global environment. I mean, very real environmental pressures. On large-scale ecosystems, at the same time that we have huge threats to our national security around, protecting and maintaining access to oil and ever-increasing demand for energy, not only in this country, but in the developing world. If they want to rise, as they should, to the standards of development and prosperity that we've enjoyed in industrialized world for quite some time. We also are seeing a hemorrhaging of our manufacturing jobs base. We need some sort of policy to reinvigorate our industrial base because American prosperity depends on our ability to produce things. The information revolution is very important, but it doesn't displace the very important role of manufacturing and production for local economies. And we're also seeing that we've had a major disinvestment in our cities, over $1 trillion of needed infrastructure investments. And all of these problems can be solved by rethinking the way that we invest in our communities. It's a fascinating area to be working in because the solution to one of these problems starts to create a positive ripple effect across the whole economy. The real problem is that we've been misplacing our priorities. We haven't been moving in the right direction. We've been failing to invest in new technology and in a forward-looking economy as we once did in this country.
The interesting thing for me and for many is the fact that this is such a wonderful alliance between workers, politicians, environmentalists, the business community. Explain why this has such broad spectrum appeal.
Well, one thing that we've done is we've spoken to people's self-interest, and we haven't led with the divisive issues. We've led with solutions. One of the things that came out of the last election was a real sort of re-examination of the political debate, and it became clear to people that Americans are hungry for a forward-looking, positive vision. Americans are really interested in being presented with solutions that actually move us forward rather than fighting over over where we've been. And, you know, we have a coalition in the Apollo Alliance that I'm extremely proud of. It includes the United Mine Workers of America. It includes the Sierra Club and the National Resources Defense Council and Greenpeace on the environmental side. It includes NAACP and farm advocates and community-based groups like the Ella Baker Center in San Francisco who fight for human rights and social justice. And it also, we have a number of forward-looking business leaders who see this, the greening of our energy infrastructure and the greening of the American economy as the next great wave of investment and jobs and growth. And we're able to hold this extremely diverse coalition together by the power of this vision and by articulating where we want to go as a country. And we think that there's potential for a huge grassroots movement around solutions, around a better vision, around building our way out of the impasse that we've found from the dead end of our current political debate. And we're seeing state coalitions spring up all around the country. We're engaged in almost half the states of the country right now at some level, whether it's been a resolution passed by a central labor council supporting the Apollo Alliance and starting to do grassroots organizing, or working with governors like we did in Pennsylvania to help pass an alternative energy portfolio standard that not only had the strong support of the environmental community but also the support of utility workers there in the Commonwealth. And now we're seeing that the real businesses are being created. In Pennsylvania, shortly after they passed their alternative energy portfolio standard that Governor Rendell signed just a couple months ago, a Spanish wind turbine manufacturer announced that it was opening a new factory to produce wind turbine blades in a part of northwestern Pennsylvania that had seen incredible devastation from the loss of jobs. And this means 500 construction jobs, building a plant, and ongoing 250 jobs manufacturing wind turbine blades. And these are sort of state-of-the-art, high-tech production. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. In California, there's a proposal to put a million solar roofs on residential buildings, on all new construction. In Washington State, we're working to support energy efficiency in all new public constructions, to say that, you know, when state budgets are invested, they should be invested in state-of-the-art technology that creates markets for green energy, for green technology, for skilled labor managing and improving these businesses. The market for solar is exploding globally. The largest producer of solar panels in the U.S. is in Memphis, Tennessee. It's owned by Sharp. You know, it's a Japanese company, but they've got a major union plant represented by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and they're producing 100 megawatts of solar photovoltaic cells that convert sunlight into electricity. That's the kind of solution-oriented job creation that we really need, and it's a way out of the current impasse.
So one of the things that we're going to need to make this happen is leadership from the top, and also we're going to have to somehow impact those who might stand in the way of this. And who might those people be? Why would anybody not want this to happen?
I think there's a crisis of imagination. You know, we need to speak to chemical workers, to oil companies, and make it clear that this potentially means jobs all the way across our economy. We're not trying to shut down industries. We're trying to create new industries. If you look at the market for biofuels, we're talking about refining, you know, farm waste. The next generation of biofuels, like ethanol, is not coming from corn. It's coming from rice hulls and switchgrass and straw, and turning out the next generation of fuels that could be you know, powering our vehicles and dramatically reducing our reliance on oil. So, you know, we need to speak to people who feel threatened by transitions in the economy. A lot of people feel very justifiably threatened if their industries are going to be impacted, if their communities are going to be impacted. You know, folks in traditional manufacturing communities are very concerned about the future of the auto industry. You know, there's more glass and carpet that goes into the manufacturing of cars in this country than goes into the manufacturing of buildings. So the ripple effect across the economy is huge from changes to the auto industry. So when auto workers hear about improving energy efficiency, you know, they're rightly scared if they think it's going to mean the loss of jobs and the outsourcing of jobs from their communities. But what we've done is to stress a vision where we're not talking about the flight of jobs, we're talking about investment in the next generation of jobs. We need policies that don't increase outsourcing, but instead accelerate the retooling of American assembly lines and the retraining of American workers and the modernization of our productive manufacturing base. You know, clearly there are issues with companies like Halliburton and Enron, who have been focused on short-term profits at the expense of long-term investment in the economy. So, you know, clearly we need to fight energy policies or investment policies that are driven by those sorts of short-term payoffs at the expense of our long-term security. That's not to say that profitability or the bottom line or short-term payoffs are inappropriate. They're necessary. We need the private sector to run with these changes, but it's not until we have a clear policy signal from our public leaders that we're going to be able to see these markets grow and flourish and the real opportunity for the next generation of jobs and growth to be realized in our economy.
Let's talk about those leaders who are behind the Apollo Alliance, and there are many.
You know, Maria Cantwell, the senator from Washington State, was one of our very early champions, and she's been a fierce advocate of electric reliability. She came from the tech sector and understands how new technologies can emerge and create just very, very broad-based opportunity across an economy. She sees clean energy as being sort of the next great wave of investment. The president of the United Steelworkers of America, Leo Gerard, has been a tremendous champion. We also work closely with the International Association of Machinists and Electrical Workers, the United Mine Workers, whole range of labor groups. We're working with the heads of most of the major environmental groups and engaging grassroots folks on the ground. We had a letter challenging, calling on federal leadership that we released in November, signed by Governor Richardson from New Mexico, Governor Granholm from Michigan, and Governor Rendell from Pennsylvania. And now we're broadening that to a bipartisan group of governors. We're talking with about a dozen different governor's offices. We're working with the lieutenant governor in Illinois on a bunch of renewables and efficiency measures. So, you know, we're seeing that this has real traction on the ground. A very interesting development, there's a group called Set America Free. That's their base is from conservatives and national security experts working with, you know, generals, former CIA head Woolsey, a number of folks who are specifically driven by concern about national security. And they're very concerned about the dangerous impacts that our over-reliance on oil is having on the security of the country and threats to not only our, you know, fighting men and women overseas, but to the long-term health and integrity of our economy. And they're focused very, very specifically on introducing biofuels and alternatives to reliance on oil and a new generation of vehicles that get radically increased fuel economy. And they're getting real traction here in Washington and around the country. So, you know, we've partnered with them. Our base tends to be more progressive. Theirs is more conservative, but we have tremendous common ground.
Well, progressive and conservative, really at this point, that is the future. And the thing that I find so interesting is that it really seems as if we're turning a corner here, as if this 100th monkey of awareness that energy independence is brilliant for our future is actually taking place.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable the degree to which we're seeing real consensus solutions emerging. And frankly, there's no silver bullet here. You know, the president has proposed a hydrogen-based solution, you know, with his Freedom Car proposal. You know, certainly that's a piece of the solution, but that's only one piece, and it probably won't be realized for 30 to 50 years out. We need to capture energy efficiency and green building now. We need renewables like wind and solar energy immediately. There's no reason that we can't invest in commercializing this next generation of bio-based fuels that come from agricultural wastes. We have a whole new generation of cars, a new generation of infrastructure. Transit is extremely important, and we're cutting back on investments in rail and transit expenditures at the very moment when we should be going full speed ahead on this. I mean, we see it around here. I live in Washington. Those places that have invested in mass transit, you're seeing tremendous economic growth. The opportunities, the real estate booms that are happening around places that are accessible to mass transit is tremendous. I mean, this is public investment that creates wealth. No question about it.
As we see oil prices now stabilizing at $54 a barrel, it certainly puts even more pressure on the broad spectrum of Americans to hop on board with the Apollo Alliance, the vision, and the dream. If people are interested in learning more about this, tell them how they can find out more.
Sure. The first step is to go to our website, and that's www.apolloalliance.org, and sign up for our list. We'll keep you posted with actions. You can find good information there, but certainly joining our listserv is very important. We're about to launch a campaign. We're working with business leaders. We want to engage the private sector more aggressively than we have. If you're a business leader, we'd love to have you on board. We're also going to be launching an Apollo Cities program in the next couple months, where we give real tools for citizen activists and really start to build a grassroots base and a membership base so that people can see progress within their own communities. And we'd love to have people come join up at apolloalliance.org and really start to turn this into a movement. It's not just a policy solution. It's really about people connecting and making change happen at the grassroots level.
I think the opportunity for people to come together and work together like this is what we absolutely need right now. We've been sort of torn apart in a thousand different ways for a very long time. We do need to come together, and I think the Apollo Alliance provides an extraordinary opportunity. First of all, to come together. Secondly, to embrace a vision. Third, to actually start to bring all of the various people involved in this together in one place and start to communicate and dream and then actually go to work and get the job done.
You know, that's what America has always done best, is to put forward an optimistic vision, to say we can master our challenges. And it's time for that sort of optimistic, hopeful spirit to be rekindled in our country, and that's what we hope to contribute to in any small way that we can, and we would welcome anyone else who wants to join us.
Bracken Hendricks, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts and your help in putting this show together today on the Wild Side News. Let's make this dream come true.
Well, thank you so much for your interest, Sydney, and you're doing really important work there with Wild Side News, and I'm a great fan of your work. So thanks for having me on.
And thank you.
The pieces are already coming together. This is not a dream. It is forging ahead in communities across America. We turn our attention next to Marco Turbovich, who represents a vast spectrum of hardworking Americans who we don't generally associate with environmentalism. Let's take a listen.
And now we direct our attention to Pittsburgh, where we're talking with Marco Turbovich, who's the assistant to the international president of the United Steelworkers of America. Marco, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Let's talk about the Apollo Alliance. First of all, your thoughts on this vision and what it may mean to yourself, to your workers, and to your community.
Well, as you may know, Sydney, there's been a tremendous hollowing out of manufacturing. Loss of almost 3 million manufacturing jobs over the last several years, and there's been an exodus of quality jobs and a race to the bottom in pursuit of cheaper labor abroad. That's one problem that our economy faces and that workers in the manufacturing sector in particular face. Secondly, there is an enormous need and an enormous public demand for greater energy efficiency and for the pursuit of energy independence, so that not only will we be less dependent on oil per se, but particularly that we'll be less dependent on oil from the Middle East and all the problems that confronts us with in foreign affairs. So the Apollo Alliance has been formed through a rather unique group of labor unions, many of them in the industrial sector, but also in the building trades, in alliance with groups that have historically been working on environmental improvement. And the perspective of the Apollo Alliance is that we can create new quality jobs in the pursuit of energy efficiency and energy independence. And so that's why it's of particular value to us. There's enormous public good can come from this in terms of a cleaner and healthier environment, but also in producing a whole new round of manufacturing innovations, of quality jobs in the manufacturing sector, as well as a lot of work among the building trades in retrofitting buildings and creating more energy efficient buildings. So that's why in particular it's of value to us at the steelworkers.
Now, steelworkers, I think the American public has an idea of people in foundries, people up on high-rise buildings and other places working with steel. How in the world would this effort to create energy independence really affect that type of work?
Well, first of all, you need to understand something that is not generally known, and that is the Steelworkers Union is one of the more diverse unions in the country. We not only represent the largest number of people in steel production, we represent the not largest number of people in the aluminum sector, workers in the aluminum sector. We represent the largest number in the rubber and tire. We also represent the largest number in mining. So all these products that are developed from various metals, from various minerals, or that might be developed in the pursuit of new product lines for energy efficiency and environmental quality have to flow from somewhere. Now, we're also committed that there is such enormous public good that comes from this that there should be a significant public investment over this. And then the Apollo Alliance is named in part after the Apollo Project, which the United States made an enormous investment in its pursuit of outer space exploration. And so likewise now we see the need for domestic exploration of new possibilities for energy efficiency and job growth.
The fact that the Apollo Project of years ago actually succeeded within 10 years is part of the inspiration for the Apollo Alliance. Tell me, do you think that we can get this job done?
Well, I think we can, because I think the old labels don't fit anymore. For instance, people are not widely aware that the Steelworkers Union, more than a decade ago, produced a document called Our Children's World, which called for greater restraints on the degradation of the environment. Now, I don't think anybody would imagine that that is something that would flow from the Steelworkers Union, but that is in fact the case. And if you were to read that document today, what it calls for reads very much like what many environmental organizations are calling for. So there's just this sense that in these industrial societies around the world, we can't continue to degrade the quality of the air and water and soil. And there's also this other need, which is for greater energy efficiency and possibly independence. And so when you look at how do you solve more than one problem at one time, when you have job loss in the manufacturing sector in addition to those things, then you see that there's some potential here for an investment at the federal level of the kind that has been made in the past in the railroads, in the airlines, or the airports, in a highway system, and in the Apollo Project itself for the exploration of outer space. We have to make a significant investment as a society in the future of our society, and our workers and our members will benefit from that, and the society will benefit from that.
Workers typically are considered the people who produce and go to work. They're not considered necessarily part of the investment community, and yet the truth is, as you say, what we're talking about here is investing in these technologies, and usually with an investment comes a dividend.
Well, actually, what you say is true, but the fact of the matter is that workers themselves in this country are the source of the largest amount of investment funds that exist, and those are in the forms of pension savings, which are indeed the deferred wages of workers. You know, when a union goes in, and as ours does, and negotiates a contract and agrees to a certain amount of pension investment, they are deferring from what would otherwise be wages they would seek. That pool of money is an enormous pool of investment capital in this country. So workers really are investors in a very, very significant way, in point of fact.
Absolutely right. Let's talk about the dividends that would come from the incredible investment in this new technology and the effort that the Apollo Alliance is forging.
Well, the economic studies that have been done by the Apollo Alliance show that if an investment were to be made in the pursuit of new jobs for energy efficiency and independence, you would create upwards of 2 million jobs, and they would be quality jobs. They would be steam fitters. They would be sheet metal workers. They would be production workers. They would be auto workers. If you're one of the major elements here is the pursuit of hybrid and high efficiency automobiles. So there's enormous potential for quality job creation out of this process. Instead of just simply subjecting ourselves to the mendacity of the global marketplaces, as seems to be currently the way that policy is pursued, largely because of flawed trade policies in this country.
Let's talk about on the ground. How are members of your union reacting to the Apollo vision?
Well, we're in the early stages of doing briefings with people about what the purposes and the mission of the Apollo Alliance is. So the reaction is generally positive. I mean, you know, the public gets way out ahead of policymakers in any number of ways. And, you know, to the public this is no shock, but it seems to be a shock always to our media elites. The public has an enormous regard for the value of manufacturing and is deeply troubled. In fact, we did, with the folks from Apollo, the steelworkers going back about a year and a half, did some polling in nine battleground states, of voters in nine battleground states, and found that there's enormous public support, bipartisan support even, for the investment of the kind that we're talking about. And, you know, you're talking about $30 billion a year for 10 years if the maximum investment were to be made in an Apollo project of the kind we're talking about. So this, the public's there. It's the political elites that need to catch up with where the public is on this. And for us, the job is to go out and educate our members through our publications, through our various conferences, and through presentations to our members. Our members are very keenly aware of it. As I mentioned, you know, our members voted in convention to endorse and support our children's world over a decade ago with these recommendations for a commitment to cleaning up the environment. So it's not like our members need to be schooled on this. They just need some basic information on the particulars of the Apollo project, and we're in the process of providing that.
Well, it is a perfect example of extraordinary common sense. And common sense, I like to think of in terms of the sense that unites us all. It is a common sense that this is what we need to get done. If we don't do this, what is the prospect for the American workers, particularly in your economic sector?
Well, the prospect of the American for the American workers in the absence of some initiative, progressive initiatives like this, is very clear because it's before our very eyes. We're at a very low savings rate. Real wages are either declining or flat. We're arguing and debating whether or not we should raise the minimum wage in this country to an absurdly low level of $7.25. And that's a political and somewhat partisan debate. You have debt levels higher than they've ever been. You've got credit levels skyrocketing. And the whole economy has been propped up by people really recapitalizing their home investments in the middle class, for which there are significant consequences in retirement. So we'll continue to go in this direction toward greater debt, lower savings, flat real wages, and disappearing manufacturing jobs. Over time, particularly on the manufacturing side, there's a hollowing out of innovation when that happens. Robert Solow, who is a Nobel-winning economist, has written that he believes that as many discoveries and productivity increases take place on the shop floor as may have taken place in research and development labs. So as you lose those jobs and as you lose those practices, those best practices from the shop floor, you lose a lot more than the jobs. You lose a certain amount of blood knowledge about manufacturing, about innovation, about productivity. And productivity is beginning to flatten out now as well. And there was a surge of productivity over the last 10 years that is in decline now. So we'll see more of the same, which is why change is necessary, which is why progress is necessary, which is why investment is necessary. And we've gone through this, you know, historically in our country when we've gone through periods of reactionary leadership, and it's run us into some very serious and dire economic times. And I think you're seeing more and more of that. I just saw a report that consumer confidence is down. Well, there's a reason for that. People live in reality. They don't live in Washington.
As we look out to the global community as well, it seems as if other nations are really aggressively moving forward in these realms. Why are we not?
I think, first of all, there is enormous influence from the oil industry and the utility industry and the minerals industries in this country that resists change of a progressive nature. And secondly, those sources of corporate interest really finance a great deal of political campaigns, and unfortunately, you know, they, our current president comes from the heartland of those economic forces and interests, and so we're not only moving in those directions, we're trying to turn the clock backwards in any number of ways. Investments by the federal government is not even something that's seriously discussed when you're talking about giving away billions of dollars, largely to the top of the food chain in the form of tax cuts. So there's got to be change in a lot of ways, not only change in policy, but change in political leadership. And in the meantime, well, those of us who aspire to create these changes just have to work more aggressively at educating the public and our constituent supporters about what those changes needed to be and what those investments need to be. And that's what we're about doing in the Apollo Alliance. And that's what the Steelworkers has been about and will continue to be about.
Strangely enough, as these issues are addressed by the politicians, it seems to me their mandate is to serve the American public, the people who elect them. But strangely enough, decisions that are being made are not protecting the American workers in America. So really, this isn't a political issue. This is an American issue.
It is an American issue, but all issues are ultimately political because people who get elected to office vote on them. I think that one of the reasons there's a great deal of cynicism in the public right now toward politicians and toward political issues is that so much of the elected officialdom of this country is in the grip of campaign finance by major contributors of all sorts. And the corporate community just enjoys enormous advantages in that regard. I mean, enormous amounts of money are thrown by various industries or the Chamber of Commerce in lobbying to either retain the benefits that they receive that may be roadblocks to progress, or to even increase the number of benefits they have to the exclusion of the public interest. So we just have to struggle to change those things, and you know that's a tough struggle given the campaign finance laws in this country.
This is a very much an American issue because America is suffering right now.
One need only look at the news this morning that energy prices and oil prices are rapidly accelerating again and will surpass $2 again. And there have been business analysts who I've read recently in publications as conservative as Barron's who've alluded to $60 and $70 a barrel oil prices in the near term before we get too far down the line. So there's an economic reality that's sitting in here about the cost of oil and the supply of oil that we have to address. And we can't wait to be confronted with those emergency circumstances to begin thinking about how to invest in ways that will alleviate the stress that's going to be created by the decline in those supplies, the demand that it will create, and the price increases that will flow from those demands.
Which brings us kind of full circles round to the fact that the Apollo Alliance, in this process of investing, actually strengthens our economy.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, it's hard to have a strong economy when people don't have decent paying jobs. Our vision of the economy of the steelworkers isn't just what the returns are on investments in the stock market or even investments by the federal government. They have to do with the implications of those investments for the well-being of the public and for our members in particular, but certainly for the general public. And when you have significant job growth, as we had in the 60s and after World War II, when you had a commitment to the American middle class and you had a federal commitment to make major investments in the airports, in the highways, and in various forms of public development from the 40s and 50s and 60s on into the 70s, you had a much better quality of life for the average middle class person. And that's changing. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before those changes weigh sufficiently upon people to create some reaction in the electorate. And I think that, frankly, I think much of that reaction is already there. It's just been, it's been sublimated somewhat by the circumstances about national security.
These are complex times. What are the next steps? How can we move this whole Apollo Alliance vision forward?
Well, the Apollo Alliance is moving projects at the state level. A lot of what the federal government ultimately concludes is necessary actually percolates up from innovations at the state level. So Apollo is working in Pennsylvania, it's working in Michigan, it's working in Wisconsin, and a number of other states to try and press forward at the state level projects that will lead to these sorts of developments. There needs to be a lot of energy invested at the grassroots level in the states. Governors are being approached by the Apollo Alliance about pursuing projects that will set a standard for this kind of development and investment. And as that obtains over time, we think we'll begin to see much more responsiveness from the Congress and from the federal government over these issues.
Marco Turbovich, I want to thank you for adding your voice. Marco is the assistant to the international president of the United Steelworkers of America. Thanks for being on the Wild Side News.
I've always been on the Wild Side, Sydney.
You're my friend. Let's talk again, and good luck to us all.
Okay.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Thanks, Marco.
So how will these new jobs find their way into our lives? Can such a greening help communities? Where will the jobs appear? And how will this affect our families and friends? We find out when we return here on the Wild Side News.
And now I'd like to introduce to the listeners Richard Feldman. He's the executive director of the King County Worker Center. Richard, tell us about the Worker Center and how you serve your community.
The Worker Center is a division of the King County Labor Council, AFL-CIO. That's the affiliation of all the different unions in the Seattle area. And we operate a group of folks that look at economic development and workforce issues and make sure that working families' voices are heard and as those policies are developed, and making sure that the policies that our community puts into place support family wage jobs.
Now, of course, the focus of today's show is the Apollo Alliance. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of why this is important for people to get on board.
Well, I'm the Washington State Coordinator for the National Apollo Alliance through our organization. And the idea that of Apollo and the Apollo Alliance has been put forward, that we have a bold challenge before us to secure our America's future, that we need to deal with energy, which is the lifeblood of a modern economy, and there's tremendous opportunities to both make sure that we're not as dependent upon foreign fossil fuel as we currently are, but there's tremendous opportunities for new manufacturing jobs and a whole series of jobs that are part of moving our country in this direction.
In San Diego this last week, I was shocked when all of a sudden I went out to get some gas, and the price of gasoline was 25 cents higher than it had been a few days earlier.
Yeah, I think you're seeing that across the country, and probably more remarkably is natural gas prices that are also increasing dramatically, and which has a really profound impact not just on our transportation what you're seeing at the gas pump, but our ability to compete in manufacturing, as well as what we have to pay to heat our homes and our businesses and run our energy supply.
Give us a sense of how this affects workers, people who keep this whole thing going.
Well, on its basic level, those price increases that we just talked about make it much more difficult to compete in energy-intensive industries. But clearly, in terms of people's personal budgets and their heating bills, their energy bills, their transportation bills, that's taking another piece out of what for many people is already a stretched budget.
In terms of your work with the Worker Center, give us a sense of what you're promoting out into your community.
We've developed a 10-point platform for Washington State that has been endorsed by all the parties, and we've come to an agreement and consensus on this 10-point platform and have started to look at opportunities to move both policies and projects that support that 10-point platform.
Can you give us an idea of some of the major points that you think are most important?
Washington State is a state that knows renewable energy for a long time. Our hydro-based economy has been around and has been a major source of economic opportunity and a fundamental part of our economy for years. So part of our 10-point platform is to increase renewable generation and energy efficiency. Our hydro economy is only going to take us so far. The next growth in our economy is requiring new energy sources. There's also issues with our hydro economy considering snowpack and its downward trend as forecasted by atmospheric scientists out of the University of Washington.
Now, what sort of renewable energy resources are you focusing on in that area?
Washington State is really blessed with a kind of wide variety, both of companies that are already in this business, and that's everything from companies that are focused on how to strengthen our power grid by making it smarter, developing technologies that support a modern era electrical grid, and that's everything from software-based technologies to technologies that directly interact with how appliances come on or come off during peak times. There's Washington State has seen some wind development happen in the eastern part of the state, and there are businesses in Seattle right now that are part of supporting that industry, building gears for gearboxes that are in wind turbines. There's companies that are looking at innovative designs to radically improve the performance of wind turbines. And those projects are going on right now, and I think that's one thing I want to emphasize, that this is not necessarily something that's off in the distant future. There's actually companies that are doing this right now that are employing people at good wages and benefits that are making energy efficiency and renewable energy projects possible. Another example, in terms of much more prosaic than we think about the beautiful photographs of the windmills, is there's a huge amount of energy resources in basic energy efficiency. That's everything from more efficient lighting to better controls to modern heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. It's been estimated that just looking at that in our buildings and looking at more energy efficiency in buildings is a $25 billion opportunity that produces incredible amounts of energy savings and moves us towards that goal of energy efficiency and energy independence.
This is beginning. The interesting aspect of this is the fact that there are people actually working on these. Money is being invested. Businesses are being created. People are going to work. This is beginning to start to create an economic base for expansion, which is the first step. What can you look forward to in terms of the growth of this particular sector of your local economy there?
Some of it is not fully predictable. I think there's some things that are going on that are going to be the new products of the future that we're just kind of understanding. But clearly the energy efficiency industry, which in Washington State employs several thousand folks, there's tremendous opportunities. In Apollo Alliance, and our perspective at Apollo Washington, is to look at bold, big projects. What if we dedicated ourselves to making every school in Washington State as energy efficient as possible? That's the existing schools. It would create a lot of jobs, provide tremendous benefits to school budgets and not having to pay higher energy costs, and would take advantage of low interest rates in terms of financing these projects. And it's a great opportunity that we should pursue and look at doing statewide.
This is an amazing moment for me personally, because I never thought about that as a simple first step, as sort of a mission and a vision. And this is the type of ingenuity that comes once we start to actually dream and do things that build a better future. The schools, obviously, are our first step, and that's just, wow, so simple.
Well, there's currently legislation that Apollo Washington is supporting before the state Senate that require new construction and new schools to follow high-performance building standards, better known as green building standards. And that has an opportunity of saving some of the projects' estimated 25% to 35% energy costs on a newly built building under those standards versus comparable buildings. I've seen estimates that our schools in the state spend in total somewhere around $100 million on energy. Anything we can do to shave that energy bill off is going to have a big impact and directly relate to having smaller classrooms and more better teacher pay if we can take that money saved and put it back into our schools. Another piece of legislation is setting standards for energy efficiency for various equipment and appliances. These are equipment and appliances that are not currently regulated under federal standards. So it's everything from those very, you know, the lamps and traffic signals to transformers on distribution systems to commercial ice makers, all these various pieces of equipment that are humming away every day, 24 hours a day, and using electricity or natural gas for their energy source. And just covering those various equipment and appliances, you'd see natural gas savings in the year 2020, nearly 3% of our current statewide consumption in the commercial sector. Now, the electricity savings alone in having these pieces of equipment be more efficient would power over 90,000 new homes. A number of states are looking at moving these exact same standards where the federal government has not moved on these. And that's also part of what we're looking at here is in the policy vacuum that's been created at the federal level in terms of making our country energy independent. It's really now up to us at the local level to move something that's going to strengthen America and our state.
Every single time that that becomes a mission, people have to go to work to try to create that. And in the process, they create new technologies.
A good example of that, again, is something that not many people know in our local area, and I think that's part of our effort to kind of highlight what's already existing.
Great.
In King County government, they run the wastewater treatment system in our area, and in Renton, they've installed the largest fuel cell of its type on their at the wastewater treatment plant that's fired off of digester gas, which is a renewable resource. And that was installed by union plumbers and electricians, and it's going to be maintained by public sector workers. And it's making about a megawatt of energy that's used on site, so it's decreasing the county's energy bill. And it's pioneering technology that, with more development, can have much more widespread implementation. And it's a great example of both federal leadership when it's there. Senator Cantwell was part of getting the pilot test grant to fund this. But it's also an example of, with our ingenuity and our, you know, American can-do spirit, there's a lot of things we can be doing, and there's these kind of fuel cells could be on every sewage treatment, wastewater treatment facility across the country of similar type that would be saving the public sector funds, that would be generating electricity from renewable resource, and creating a bigger market, which, of course, then lowers the cost.
Well, Richard, you've given us some great examples of on-the-ground things that people can do and are doing. If people want to contact you to find out more about what's happening in Washington State and beyond, how can they do so?
Probably best by email. Maybe they can go to your site to get that email address.
I'll be happy to post that so that people can link to your website. Richard Feldman, thank you so much for adding your voice to the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you for everything you do.
Jobs from new technologies. Lots of jobs. Good paying jobs. So now, let's take a look at how the new greening of American technologies will lead to a greening of our economy. When we return here on the Wild Side News. And now I have Andrew Beebe on the line. He's president of Energy Innovations. Andrew, where are you calling us from?
I'm in Pasadena, California.
A great area for technology and innovation for sure. Your focus really is on the way in which strategies that the Apollo Alliance are outlining could affect technological developments. Help us understand that better.
Sure. You know, we have a great team. We're a small company, 35 people, and we have a great team of engineers coming out of places like Caltech and taking homegrown American technology and trying to build worldwide and world-changing products to help with clean energy.
The Apollo Alliance dream fits right into your mission. What sort of technologies are people in your industry talking about?
Well, what we're doing specifically at Energy Innovations is building solar technology for large commercial and institutional rooftops. And what we're really focused on is sort of breaking the cost barrier. Historically, renewable technology and clean technology has been viewed as too expensive. And usually it's viewed that way because it is. It is not cost competitive today with centralized, large-scale, dirty power generation. Until you do double bottom line accounting and things like that to account for the cost of that pollution, you really can't see an apples-to-apples comparison. and what our technology and what a lot of people in our kinds of fields and here in the U.S. and in other places are doing, really proving that we're so close now that you really can get over the finish line with great research and product design in terms of being cost competitive.
Is that going to be happening somewhat soon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think even when you ask, you know, the more conservative players in the space like Sharp Electronics in Japan, who make solar panels that are sold around the world, you know, they'll tell you, look, we've been doing this for 20 years, and in the next 10 years, we will definitely be cost competitive. We, of course, want to ratchet that up and get there in a couple of years. So I do think it's a real dream, not just in sort of this generation, but in this decade, and I think that's thrilling. I think beyond solar, I'm very focused on solar technology, but beyond that, when it comes to things like transportation, where I think you'll see a dramatic shift in reliance on foreign fuel sources, I think we have a little bit longer to go, but there's fantastic innovation there as well. I mean, we see hydrogen technology companies happening all the time, particularly in California, where we're actually now building some of the first real sort of hydrogen infrastructure, where we're building the first fueling stations up and down the state. They're in sort of helping to solve that chicken and egg problem of hydrogen cars needing hydrogen fueling stations. There are a lot of other pieces of that puzzle that need to be solved in terms of cost reduction, but those are great steps forward.
Talk to us about the power of innovation, where one innovation actually engenders and inspires many new technologies that we can't even know about. Certainly that happened in the digital revolution. We're living with realities that we never even imagined.
That's right. I mean, I think these are sort of what I would call platform technologies, just like IP, Internet Protocol, is a platform technology that then transformed every other industry. When you look at power generation, power storage, power transportation, you are looking at platform technologies. So just an example, when there's another company in the solar space called Konarka, which is designing small solar panels that can be essentially built into plastic and other kinds of materials so that when you build a laptop, the back of that laptop can be solar powered and thus actually literally free you from cables and free you from electricity, which is usually based on coal and other fossil fuels. Those kinds of things are so enabling, it sort of boggles the mind as you go down the path of, okay, so you could actually build it into the paint for the for automobiles, and it won't power the entire car, but it certainly helps bring down the fuel reliance. All those different kinds of things are real platforms. Hydrogen is clearly a platform as well. And, you know, America doesn't have a monopoly on innovation, but I do believe that if you look historically and certainly what's going on right now in a lot of areas, and of course what happened with the Internet, we do have some wonderful sort of perfect storm of opportunity in terms of venture capital, in terms of great universities and research labs, in terms of great government support, usually for a number of different programs that help bring on this kind of research. I think you do see we have a head start in a lot of R&D and a lot of product creation in new fields.
Many people are suggesting that we aren't necessarily getting the national leadership that is required to do this.
Yeah.
A commitment at the national level to really fund and inspire this type of movement to energy independence. Lacking that, do you believe that the private sector is going to be able to step up to the plate?
Yes and no. I think it really is field dependent. In places like solar, where solar is a wonderful field because we have very little, there isn't that much regulatory need in the sense that a lot of states have passed and utilities have been finally supportive of things like net metering laws that allow you to sell your power back to the grid and back to the utility, now passed, I think, in the vast majority of states and certainly important ones like California. And so we're less reliant on regulation and government support. We don't need to go through regulatory hoops to put in solar farms and whatnot, because what we're doing on rooftops is really just about extra equipment. Now, in other fields like hydrogen, where more research dollar is needed to get us closer to the commercialization finish line, I think we're going to be hard-pressed to get there without a greater sense of government support, maybe not federal, but state and or federal. And, you know, I think the other interesting slice on this is that when you really look at the people who are getting excited about renewable technology and getting excited about breaking the cost barriers for all of these different fuel sources and power generation sources, it's not a Democrat or a Republican sort of battle. Those people are really all over the political landscape. And what they will all tell you is that historically, and of course today, if you look at coal and nuclear and other technologies and energy, they have wild subsidies, and they have from day one, and oil prospecting, of course, in the early days did as well. So they've all simply pointed to that and said, let's do the same thing for more homegrown American technologies in the energy sector, and let's do it so that we're not paying for both sides of these wars around fossil fuels.
Because you're involved in solar, there's kind of two ways to look at this. One is sort of unwiring, that is to go to a very local, even rooftop-produced solar into a home. And, of course, the others for areas where that may not be practical, where, for example, there's a lot of bad weather or cloudy days, then they're going to have to rely on other sort of larger arrays in different areas. Tell us how that's shaping out into the industry.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, we see a vision clearly of an energy web, which is what we've always had, meaning just like any given city, we'll have buses and trains and different kinds of transportation systems to meet the needs of different citizens. We see an energy web across the country that is many, many different fuel sources. And really, that's sort of smart on a bunch of levels. You want to diversify because of the fuel availability, but also because of technology needs and because of things like weather. So certainly, certain areas will use a lot of wind. Certain areas may use a lot more solar. The West and Southwest will use a lot more solar, although we're now seeing a lot of solar in the Northeast as well. But ultimately, the vast majority of our power for a very long time is going to come from what we call traditional sources, which includes hydro, but is really driven by natural gas and coal. And that's why we're also very supportive of finding ways to make particularly natural gas a better process for extraction and try and find ways to reduce our reliance on coal, which is really still the dirtiest of the fossil fuels.
One of the big challenges is in modeling this integration of the energy web. Are you finding areas and corporations and others who are really starting to make some progress in that arena? And this is going to be the exciting part of the development of this whole strategy, is that there will be whole new systems of putting this all together, but it is going to have to be addressed, or we're going to end up with an 8-track tape system as opposed to a DVD,
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the idea that we're modeling a smarter grid over time and also modeling loads so we can manage different regional loads much more safely and without brownouts and blackouts is obviously, I think, at the top of a lot of utility lists in terms of things they want to get done. And solar can help, but also be a challenge in that sense. We take a lot of the power demand offline because of solar, but then it can be sporadic with clouds and whatnot during the day, even when most of our customers will be grid connected. So I think there are a lot of challenges there, and I think you're going to see great innovation in terms of software and new companies serving that industry. I mean, we see those already. So that's another exciting area of innovation that hopefully the entrenched players in the utilities, who are generally slow to adopt new technology because they've got to manage such a commodity and critical sort of foundation for the country, hopefully they will start to dig in on those new technologies.
You're talking about actually all of these new technologies that are potentially going to come into place, and I believe will be. I believe that is where our economic future lies. Have you done any studies, or are you familiar with some of the projections of really how many jobs may be created as these technologies are integrated?
The simple fundamentals are wonderful to ponder. I mean, I think these products will be global, and this market will be global, and we may end up buying panels from Japan or from China or whatever. But at the end of the day, unlike buying oil from the Middle East or South America or Russia, you buy some piece of equipment from anywhere. Maybe it's made in America, maybe it's not. And then you bring it here. It's got to be installed and maintained by people here in this country. Same with wind technology. Even if the wind turbines happen to come from Denmark, by the time they get here and get installed in Minnesota or in Cape Cod or wherever they're going, you're going to see all of that owned and operated and maintained by America and Americans, and probably American companies. And so just with that fundamental, you know that this is never something that we've got to have a political battle about outsourcing or anything like that. We, in the solar industry, certainly we've seen those jobs reach into the hundreds of thousands very quickly. And in California, just as an anecdote, we're seeing that play out at a smaller scale right now in a big way. We've got 10 megawatts being installed per year of commercial solar, and this is peanuts in the grand scheme of power, and yet it's equating to thousands and thousands of jobs here, and that's become quite an industry, and an industry that's getting a lot of attention in Sacramento, and something I think the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is very excited about.
As these corporations come online and people go to work, the really exciting thing is the fact that if we just keep the momentum growing, we have long-term quality jobs, which will be available to people who are looking for jobs because they've been displaced by old technologies or through movement to other nations.
When you look at the power industry, it is literally the largest industry in the world. It's a multi-trillion dollar industry. And I mean, it's hard to ponder, but simply put, it's bigger than food and transportation and other large industries. And yet, I guess we don't think of it this way, but we've had a policy of outsourcing that for a very long time in the United States. And, you know, if the fossil fuel promoters have their way, they are starting to take things like natural gas and do outsourcing there as well. They're saying, you know, there's not quite enough in the Rockies, and we're doing everything we can there. We've got to start doing liquefied natural gas transportation, which in the past was seen as sort of crazy just because of the costs. But now as costs rise, it seems a little bit more logical. And that means, you know, it's sort of like we've seen this movie before, and it doesn't end well. We're going to have to go to Nigeria. We're going to have to go to the Middle East. We're going to have to go to places that we've had a lot of problems with in the past just on oil, and now go get natural gas. So I think we're sort of setting up for, you know, the 2.0 version of this, and that's something I don't think anyone's too excited about.
When you look out across America, are you finding neighborhoods or communities where some of these concepts are really being integrated in exciting ways?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the city of San Francisco has just gone really deep on the solar front, and, you know, there are foggy parts of San Francisco, but there's a lot of sun there. And so they're starting to champion a real integrated approach to making solar a reality, also making biofuels and hybrid vehicles, and even looking at fuel cell ferries and other things for their transportation systems, a reality. And I think that that kind of, and the East Bay people are doing that a lot as well in the Berkeley and Oakland area, and we're certainly seeing it in the Seattle area. So those kinds of integrated approaches citywide, to me, make perfect sense, just in the way, you know, you're seeing a lot of communities say, hey, we should have broadband access for everybody. In fact, it should be wireless and it should be free, because not as a sort of subsidy, but because it's so inexpensive to do. When you start to see people say, well, if we can aggregate the buying power of the big purchases of power of this city, if we can take the power generation assets that we have and try and find ways to make them greener, when we do public housing, if we can make solar and other renewable technologies part of that process, just like they're doing with green building, I mean, we're starting to see that just sort of take everywhere. It becomes a no-brainer, you know, something, you know, why wouldn't you do it?
What would it take to really get this off the ground?
I mean, I think this, the concept of, you know, an Apollo Alliance or an Apollo Project, the idea that the federal government or even just a group of state governments would get together and say, wait a second, you know, in fact, you know, the President Bush, unfortunately, made a lot of these kinds of claims, but then started doing the opposite with his money. He made claims about freedom cars and hydrogen fuel cells and hydrogen research, and I think it was, you know, something like 0.01% of the money devoted to that compared to what was devoted to new coal research. Obviously a pretty profitable industry, but still getting great handouts from the government. I think if we flip the tables on that a little bit and said, let's put a couple of weeks worth of a war in Iraq into this kind of research, we would get over the hump. And the specific statistic in the solar industry is, we know for a fact that if there were $25 billion worth of purchases, which is really just two more years of purchases at the grand level of solar, we would be able to, just because of the scale that would create in manufacturing, we'd be able to reach cost competitiveness with grid power in a lot of states. So things that could happen, the government could easily just place some very, very large orders for military bases and things like that, which they're starting to do, but they could kick that up and start to become a major, you know, a major buyer of these green power sources. Those kinds of things would make a massive difference. On the hydrogen front, I think just direct research dollars and support for university laboratories and other national labs that are doing great work there will go a long, long way, not just sort of handouts for big car companies.
You know, it's interesting. the way that this begins to really happen is that we start to communicate, and that's ultimately what the Wild Side News is here to do, is to bring all the voices together. And I heard, for example, up in Washington, there are school districts now that are really focusing on adding solar to all new school construction. What a great, simple concept that could make enormous differences at every level.
That's right. In California, we're doing the same thing. In fact, our company is doing installs for what's called the Solar Schools Program. And you're just starting to see it everywhere. There's a wonderful double benefit there as well. You get, really green schools, and oftentimes that means more healthy if they were doing on-site generation before with diesel generators or natural gas generators. But you also get to educate the future about these kinds of technologies. And we're working with a community college out in the desert here in California that spends a lot of its effort doing trades training to help students find ways into different trades and different types of work. And so we're actually working with them on building a solar farm that will be something that students can learn on and learn about maintenance and operation of these renewable technologies, because that school, like a lot of other places, has realized this is the future of real jobs in America that are going to persist. And I think we'll see more and more of that, and that's just sort of an exciting example of what's going to happen in the next decade in this field.
I think an interesting tertiary spin on that is the fact that whereas students who learn about in things that relate to the environment are oftentimes confronted with disaster and catastrophe and hopelessness, that suddenly they're in a school where environmental education is involved in hope and answers and solutions to their future.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Andrew Beebe, President of Energy Innovations. When people want to contact you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, the best way is just to come to our website. It's www.energyinnovations.com. And, we're just a small company here in Pasadena trying to change the world with some low-cost solar. But if anybody wants to learn more, that's a great way to go.
Well, I'm extending my hand through the phone line here to you to shake hands, and let's keep on working together.
Thank you so much. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Andrew.
Okay.
The power of the Apollo Alliance is reaching into places that often are overlooked. The nation as a whole is arming itself with new technologies in the most unusual places. We see how America's original native peoples view this new American vision when we return with more Voices of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. Now I'd like to welcome Bob Goff, who is the Secretary for the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy. Bob, why don't you tell us what that actually translates as?
Intertribal Council on Utility Policy is an organization of tribes interested in developing recommendations and policies that enhance tribal utilities, whether it's telecommunications or energy-based utilities on reservations in the Northern Plains.
For some reason, the Apollo Alliance seems to meld with your visions for Native Americans across America. Tell us why.
Well, I think looking at a number of factors, we've got a rather parallel agenda. We've looked at issues in the Northern Plains, the persistent drought, the threat of climate change, long-term drought conditions extending there, that have basically diminished our hydropower resource in the Missouri River, the Upper Missouri River. And tribes there have looked to the tremendous opportunities in renewables, particularly wind energy, which is not only a clean generator of electricity, and we've got probably the sweet zone in the country across the Northern Plains, Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, for the production of wind energy. But it's also an energy form that doesn't consume water, and it has the advantages of ultimately being able to provide jobs and a basis of a vibrant, sustainable economy for Indian tribes in the Northern Plains and elsewhere across the country.
So in terms of your interest, you would be interested in literally setting up alternative energy sources, wind, solar, and others. And then what would be the outcome of that locally?
Locally, tribes have a very great energy need. If you live on an Indian reservation, you may be aware that you're 10 times more likely not to even have electricity in your household than anywhere else in the country. And if you do have electricity on a reservation, you are more likely paying a far higher percentage of your household income to consume that power. So there's some very important reasons for tribes to want to be able to generate their own power, be in charge of that economy, have that the kind of economy that meets local needs. But because of our tremendous resources of renewables, one of our tribal chairmen, Chairman Tex Hall up at Fort Berthold, was looking at the map of the resources on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, and he said that they've got 17,000 times more power in the wind than they can use on the reservation. So whenever you have that kind of surplus of potential resource, you don't mind gearing an economy towards being able to meet your own needs and exporting that to other uses in the region.
So these new technologies would actually bring income, conceivably, sizable income to the tribes themselves.
That's true, and conceivably income for a long, long, long period of time. The idea of a sustainable resource wherein after 30 years you don't end up with a large hole in the ground with water table issues, water problem, water pollution issues, air pollution issues. At the end of 30 years, you've still got 100% of your resource left, and you've been able to enjoy a revenue stream from the energy produced.
Now, I know that a lot of Native American tribes make quite a bit of their income from oil and gas leases around the country. How would these two different systems work together?
Well, oil and gas tend to feed transportation and to some extent electricity with the gas, but that runs on separate pipelines, and reservations across the West are blessed with an amazing variety of resources. But most of the tribes have not been in the position of owning the generation facilities and the like. It's usually been off-reservation corporations that have come on and set up and worked out deals and the like, with few exceptions. But renewables is something where you don't need to set up a 500 megawatt power plant to be able to get into the business. You can do it incrementally, 20 megawatts, 40 megawatts, 80, 100 megawatts. These are smaller projects in terms of their economic capital upfront costs and are within the realm of tribes being able to build their capacity, develop it, grow it, and own and operate and then thus fully benefit from ownership of these facilities.
The startup of various oil and gas production facilities does involve labor, but that eventually ends, and then pretty much the labor pool is dissipated. You're really looking at a transformation where this could become an ongoing manufacturing system and means of providing jobs and sustainable futures.
We would love to be able to attract wind turbine, solar panel manufacturers to reservations for the employment that it would bring and for the generation of revenue on that, as well as constructing and operating the facilities on the reservation. We are looking at training crews for the construction, installation of large-scale wind turbines, and these are, you know, towers that reach 200, 300, 400 feet into the air and have blade spans 77, 80 feet long. There's some very specialized work there with the crane operators, but there's some very important work that could be easily trained for with regard to the foundation building and the ongoing maintenance on those levels. Once crews are trained up to do that, as development takes place off the reservation as well, tribes could be in the position with the trained labor pool to be able to meet those off-reservation needs as well. We're looking at the spin-off industries that could grow around energy production on the reservation, such as utilizing it at home for greenhouses and other kinds of industries that would also employ people, and things like greenhouses. You've got the better winds are in the fall, winter, and springtime, and that's not our normal growing season. So to be able to extend the growing season, provide good nutrition to the communities and to, provide maybe vegetables to a regional market. These are the kinds of things we're also looking at tying into sustainable renewable energy development.
Now, in terms of where you are now and where you hope to be in the future, where do things stand and what are you hoping? I mean, what's actually on the ground these days?
Well, we've got, quite proudly, the first large-scale wind development project to be totally owned by an Indian tribe on the Rosebud Reservation that was erected in the February of 2003. That has been sort of a landmark showing that tribes can organize to build and finance a project. And we took that particular project through a lot of hoops to be able to understand the industry. And right now, Rosebud is looking to probably follow up with a 30-megawatt plant, which is about the economy of scale that size brings in, an economy of scale that makes the projects economic. We're looking to then follow that up with an 80-megawatt wind turbine project that would be intertribally owned and operated through a group of 8 tribes. It would be a large distributed generation utility scale project, 8 reservations, 10 megawatts apiece, scattered over the course of over the grid that stretches between 3 states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska.
A lot of people associate casinos with Indian reservations. Are you forming partnerships potentially with casinos to look into the possibility of getting their involvement economically and in other ways to support these endeavors?
Absolutely. The first turbine there at Rosebud sits on the hill just overlooking the Rosebud Casino and Hotel, and that's the same place where the tribe is now looking at building a truck stop and larger facility. So there'll be plenty of energy use right there on the reservation for that turbine to be able to be used. And if you look at most reservations, those that do have casinos, they are probably one of the better loads on the reservation. They use burn a lot of energy, use a lot of electricity with the lights and the machines and air conditioning, heating, and the like. And those things run all year 24/7 very often. So that's the kind of base load that you'd like to be able to serve with an energy generation system.
Native Americans carry a legacy of being people who are very sensitive and connected to the larger realms of nature and the environment. What kind of discussion is going on amongst the tribes about the way in which this may actually serve to keep nature and the environment intact?
Well, at home in the Dakotas, we're extremely conscious of the environment, particularly with the changes we've seen just over the last 5 to 7 years. We've been sitting in a persistent drought in the northern Great Plains. The upper Missouri River is as low as it's ever been historically, and we're seeing, you know, reduced snowpack in the Rockies and Wyoming and Montana, and far less rainfall in the western parts of the Dakotas. So there's less and less water going into the Missouri system. Now, that Missouri River has provided the region with good, clean energy over the last 40, 50 years with the dams on the Missouri River. But as the water levels go lower and lower on the Missouri, there's less and less hydropower produced. In the course of the last 30 years, because demand has outgrown even the capacity of those dams, we've seen a lot of coal plants be built up in the region to provide coal power. We are today seeing that coal thermal power being generation being threatened by the fact that those systems require water for cooling. They evaporate thousands of gallons a minute of water just to cool down the steam that's used to produce the generation. Most power is produced with the most conventional fossil fuel power burns to boil water. Water creates steam. Steam generates the power. Then you've got to cool that steam down, and that's where a lot of water is consumed. And we're seeing today that the rivers are so low, the reservoirs are so low, that they're needing extension pipes to be able to even bring the water when it's available to cool these plants. So we're seeing curtailments occur in the Wyoming power plants. We're seeing curtailments threatening conventional generation below the dams as well, because there isn't that much water to release. So really, you look at the environment in the Northern Plains, we've built an energy system on hydro and thermal that also requires water, and we're seeing under these drought conditions that that whole energy system may be in somewhat in jeopardy. Wind in that same system consumes no water and brings energy with no air emissions either. So we think there's a real contribution tribes could make to bringing reliability, a certain amount of redundancy to the energy system, to be sure that we've got a good long-term system that doesn't further threaten the environment.
Now, for people who want to know more about what is happening on the reservations and in the tribes throughout North America and the United States, how can they find out more information?
I would suggest they might turn to a website, www.energyindependenceday.org. And this is a campaign that's very unique, actually. It's a collaboration between a number of tribes who are interested in renewable generation and about 40 cities of the 150-some U.S. cities that have signed on to the global warming statements that the mayors have issued. They've looked and they said that many of the cities have taken global warming as a serious threat to their own local budgets, their own local environments, and they're looking to see what they can do within their own jurisdictions to reduce their emissions of carbon dioxide and other global warming gases, and they want to reduce the emissions through energy efficiency and renewables. And the tribes have issued an invitation to partner, cities and tribes, counties and tribes, to partner with tribes being able to produce some clean generation for consumption in the urban areas where most of our energy is actually utilized. So there's a great opportunity there, and anyone interested can go to that website, energyindependenceday.org.
What is it about the Apollo Alliance that you think works so effectively at uniting the efforts of the people and the tribes throughout America, and then America in its larger spectrum?
Well, the Apollo Alliance has recognized the great opportunity this whole country has, whether it's environmental or national security, to look at local production of clean, renewable energy, and we see that falls right in line with a lot of the work that we're doing. They're looking at a variety of policies that can enhance the promotion of renewable energy, as well as bringing the jobs that can come with it to meet local job demand and local energy production.
It's a great opportunity for all of us to really come together in a kind of a new national vision.
I think so. They've been looking at a number of variety of policy options for governments and for communities around the country, and we're right now looking to work with them to see how some of those options may be crafted to fit into the tribal context as well.
Excellent. Bob, is there anything else that we should know about?
Well, I think we're going to be out in California sometime this summer. The Conference of Mayors, I think, is looking at energy issues within their jurisdictions. I think there's an opportunity. California has taken a great leadership role amongst the states. I've got the honor of serving on the Western Governor's Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee, which was put together at the request of the governors of California and New Mexico. And we're looking at goals of 30,000 megawatts of clean new generation and 20% energy efficiency goals to be met by the year 2015. So we're hoping to poise tribes to be able to participate in this so that states from the Dakotas West will be able to work together, tribes, states, cities where a lot of the power is consumed. So I think there's a great opportunity for a whole new wave of development in the West that sort of floats all boats, brings the economies and employment opportunities to rural and urban areas.
Well, Bob Goff, Secretary for the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
It's a great pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity.
But what about our inner cities? Can the Apollo Alliance float the boats of those who have been paddling for too long without a good oar? We find out as we head back to the city and onto the streets when we bring you the voice of the earth from Oakland, California, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm talking with Van Jones, who is the executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Van, why don't you tell us, first of all, about the Ellen Baker Center?
Well, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights is a criminal justice organization, actually. We focus on youth in prisons and trying to reduce the number of kids who wind up unnecessarily locked up. We also have worked on police accountability and misconduct issues. But as we've grown, we've come to realize that there's no such thing as a single issue. And the neighborhoods where a young person might be subjected to police violence, it's the same neighborhood where there's an asthma epidemic because of pollution or cancer clusters and joblessness. And so we decided last year to launch a new project called Reclaim the Future. And our slogan is Green Jobs, Not Jails. Green Jobs, Not Jails is our slogan. And the idea is that we think that we should be investing our money not in these massive prisons, and you spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 per person in there, and get nothing out of it except more damage to those people and to those communities. We should take that money and invest it in creating earth-honoring jobs that will lead to peaceful streets, will improve community and environmental health, because you're putting people to work in the industries that are about healing, whether that's permaculture or putting up solar panels, or whether that's organic food. We think that we don't have any throwaway neighborhoods. We don't have any throwaway species or resources or kids. It's all sacred, and we want to reorient the way we're spending our public dollars out of the gray gulag economy of prisons and into a living green economy. That's what we're about.
Tell us how this would actually be implemented in your neighborhoods. Tell me, first of all, who you really are serving there, the breadth of your community, and then how you see, for example, the Apollo Alliance and their vision really manifesting in your community.
Well, I think what you have to understand from the very beginning is that we have, I think, entered the third wave of environmentalism in North America. Of course, you used to not need an environmental movement because for thousands and thousands of years you had good environmental stewardship by the indigenous population here. But after the invasion, within 100 years or so, you needed an environmental movement. And the first wave of that was the Teddy Roosevelt kind of conservation era. And then we had in the 60s, starting with Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring, a second phase, which was conservation plus regulation. And that proceeded and progressed, and the environmental justice community came in and made sure that there was a racial justice awareness around regulations and all that kind of stuff. Now, in the new century, you've got a third wave. It's conservation plus regulating the bad plus investing in the good. So investing in solar, in permaculture, in organic, in all of these new clean, green technologies, the things that bioneers have been talking about. We can get to zero waste and zero pollution by clustering industries and using natural processes. All of these things amount to a green wave, you might say, a new approach. Our question, though, because we work in communities where there's poverty, racism, low-income people of color, our question is this: will the green wave lift all boats? Will the green wave, all these new jobs, these new technologies, this new wealth creation, will it lift all boats, or will it just lead to what we call eco-apartheid? Will Marin County here in Northern California have eco-this and bio-that and solar-this? Meanwhile, Oakland, 15 minutes away, is choking in the last century's pollution-based economy. Our position is that the new clean and green economy that's beginning to emerge needs to be governed by a certain principle. That principle is this. Those communities that were locked out of the last century's pollution-based economy must be locked in to the new clean and green economy. That's what we're about. And so what we're trying to bring into being and what we're trying to ensure happens is that we build a track, that we create, for instance, green job training centers in urban America, where young people who are at risk or formerly incarcerated can be trained to be solar engineers and can be trained to help retrofit buildings and can be trained in permaculture. We want to see our neighborhoods, which are right now decimated by underinvestment and redlining from banks, we want our neighborhoods declared as green enterprise zones where private and public and community partnerships can be created, again, to create jobs and to replace either closed factories and businesses or polluting factories and businesses with green and clean factories and businesses. That is how we come to the Apollo Project. We see the Apollo Project as an opportunity, concretely, to ensure that people of color, low-income people, formerly incarcerated people, at-risk youth, have a place at the table as we begin to design a new clean energy economy and create jobs and wealth on that basis.
Where are you guys at in this process now? You know, if people come into the Oakland area a year from now, 2 years from now, and let's go look at 10 years from now, that is what the Apollo Alliance, that's kind of their timeline. What do you see happening?
Our main job right now is advocating that these new initiatives, whether it's the Apollo Project or Bioneers or any of these new initiatives, have the proper conception so that there is a place reserved for communities that may have never heard of the Apollo Project, but desperately need clean energy and the jobs that come with clean energy, the wealth that comes from creating clean energy, and the environmental benefits of clean energy, but they don't even know this is going on. So our main role right now is a public education role. We're advocating, making sure that as these new sectors come online, they are aware, and we're doing community-based education so that community-based organizations are aware that there is a new opportunity here. As you know, many people in our communities, you know, feel despairing. Will there ever be any reinvestment in any of these urban areas? We're saying that investment can't happen. Can't happen and is happening. We have to make sure that we are players. So in the short term, it's a community education advocacy role. In the middle term, and you'll see this even by the end of this year, we are working to gather the people who are doing the reentry for people with prisons. There are numerous reentry programs. None of them are targeted toward this new economic opportunity. There are numerous youth violence prevention programs that are not targeted in this direction. We are working with them to get them on board. And there are also numerous people who are, numerous organizations that are teaching people how to live clean and green. They aren't usually focused on at-risk and formerly incarcerated populations. So there's some matchmaking and some education work that needs to happen, again, to till the soil and make it possible for a green economy to take root in urban America.
You know, it almost feels as if in a community, as you're talking about, your community in the Oakland area there, where you have a lot of inner city youth and others, that by focusing on this at this point, you may actually end up in the lead. Because many other communities that are more suburban or, you know, just economically more privileged may not be focusing on these issues because kind of life goes on, you know?
Well, that would be my hope, is that, you know, sometimes it's the necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. And we might say necessity is the mother of adaptation and innovation. And so we're hoping, frankly, that by the time America as a whole catches on to this phenomenon, it's already been branded not as a sort of, you know, white, elite, you know, middle class, affluent phenomenon, but really as a new social uplift environmentalism, an environmentalism with its sleeves rolled up, with its fingernails dirty, helping to take on not just the toughest environmental problems or the toughest energy problems, but really the toughest economic and social problems as well. We have no doubt that the most efficient and rational community safety program is centered on the creation of green jobs, because that is the most efficient use of public and private dollars. When people are employed, they tend to be less likely to engage in underground economic activity. When people are employed in healthy industries, they tend to be healthy, live in healthier communities, and therefore are less of a burden with regard to the public hospital system, etc. When you begin to look at green jobs as a knockout solution for economic, environmental health, social, community safety, and other issues, one realizes, hey, we need not despair about urban America. We really could have reached the bottom of the crisis there, and we now have an ability, out of desperation, to think very creatively about greening our cities as a way to save the environment and also to save our children.
In a community as in Oakland, a lot of the people there are really looking for advancement, economic advancement. They want a better life. They want things to be, they just want to prosper. And yet so much of the environmental movement has been associated with sort of cutting back and not consuming and things. How do you bridge that gap?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, here's the problem. There are some communities that need to reduce their consumption down to a level of dignity. There are some communities that are over-consuming and that are wasteful. And there the challenge is, how do we get that level of consumption down to a dignified level? There are some communities that are under-consuming. They're hungry. You look and say, oh, well, you know, how can there be hunger in the inner cities? They have an obesity epidemic. There's an obesity epidemic because people don't have access to healthy food and they're eating food that's incredibly bad for them and fattening, but it's not healthy food. And so you have, in the urban environments, you have people who are under-consuming, who don't have enough money to really make ends meet. And there you want to bring up their level of consumption to a level of dignity. Different communities have different challenges. And what we want to see is a creation of jobs, wealth, environmental benefit in communities that lack those things. And we want those communities that have those things to be generous in terms of sharing the wealth, sharing the expertise, and working in partnership. The big problem in America has been the big social and racial divide between rich and poor, white, black, and otherwise. But all of us have to share this earth. All of us have to have to think about our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and what is their inheritance from an environmental point of view. And that becomes a common ground, and that becomes a common cause, conceivably, where, again, greening the cities with, you know, trying to reach zero poverty, zero pollution, and zero displacement in our urban environment really becomes a common ground project for all of America with benefits for the whole country. Not charity, not sympathy, not welfare, but an aggressive, visionary, solution-oriented, hard-headed investment strategy that can begin to change our country.
Now, in terms of investment within the black community, are you finding people with resources, people from the entertainment industry or from the sports industry or just from wherever, whatever industries they're being successful in, stepping up to this, seeing this vision, participating?
We're still early. It's a brand-new project. I mean, we've talked only with Alfre Woodard, who, as you know, is a famous actress and tremendous actress. She is certainly quite sympathetic and wants to be supportive of our work against over-incarceration in general. We have not asked or invited any of the potential donors, black or white, on the investor side to step up to the plate because we want to make sure that, again, the right populations are in a position to take advantage. In other words, it would be very easy to run out the door with an Apollo-style program. And if you just start right now, the people who are going to benefit from it are the affluent. They're going to get it. They're going to get involved. We want to make sure that before large amounts of money are spent on anything, that we've done the careful work, the delicate work of getting those at-risk, formerly incarcerated populations in a position to play along with everyone else. And that requires training. That requires investment. That requires expertise transfer. And those are things we're focused on right now.
Well, Van Jones, I want to wish you great success, and if there's ever anything that I can do, as I am doing right now, trying to make sure that anybody in the world can hear this message,
yeah,
including people in Oakland and everywhere else,
yeah,
you just let me know, because really this is an opportunity for America to move forward together. It transcends color. It,
yeah,
it really is an opportunity, as you say, almost to lift up all the boats, and I do think those who are sort of struggling to find their way in America have a terrific opportunity. It creates jobs, it creates hope, and as well, it creates health in our communities.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. Anyone who's interested in contacting us at ellabakercenter.org. That's E-L-L-A-B-A-K-E-R, center, spelled out, .org. We'd be happy to hear from you. Reclaim the Future is our new project. We're going to be debuting it at the UN's World Environment Day celebrations, June 1st through the 5th in San Francisco this year. That's June 1st through the 5th, San Francisco, UN World Environment Day. It's there that we will debut our Reclaim the Future. The theme of the World Environment Day this year is Green Cities, and we want to make sure that the Green Cities vision includes some brown folks. So that's going to be our mission at the World Environment Day, and I just appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk with you about our work.
Van Jones, Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, I want to thank you so much for taking such a leading role and really stepping out and making this a vision that is embraceable amongst all people, but in particular amongst people in your community.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks. So after all this, we finally return to the, well, one of the legendary old environmental standard bearers. We next visit with the Sierra Club. Where does this ancient American environmental giant stand as the Apollo Alliance counts down to launch? We'll find out when we return here on The Voice of the Earth. John Muir, if you're listening, take a look at what you started. Now joining us from Washington, D.C. is David Hamilton, who is the Director of Global Warming and Energy Programs for the Sierra Club. Dave, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
Our focus today, as you know, is on the Apollo Alliance, and the Sierra Club has been early on a supporter of so much of what the Apollo Alliance is trying to do. Give us a sense of why the Sierra Club is so willing to participate in the Apollo Alliance vision.
Well, Apollo came up with a way to look at our energy problems that inspires people. And, you know, in the environmental field, there is often too much to talk about that's bad and too much to talk about that's negative. And Apollo, you know, lays out a picture that people can work for and people can get excited about. And it's, you know, putting American ingenuity and American effort and sweat and elbow grease into building a better future environmentally and economically for all of our children and all of our families. That's been something that's very easy to follow for an awful lot of different groups, and it's been a point of coming together for a great many interests that have sometimes been in conflict.
As the Apollo